You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Honest AF Show with me, Daniela Clark.
And me, Barbara Ann Wild.
And Miss Barbara Ann Wild, it's always a good day when you show up.
I love coming here.
Oh, God.
I
hate it when I don't see you. So today we have an extra bonus. Not only do I get to see Miss Barbara Ann Wild, but I also have an old friend of mine in the studio. And oh my God. So I'll introduce you guys. Her name is Regina Benelli.
Hi. Right? Hello, Regina Benelli.
Welcome, Regina.
Hi, girls.
Hi. So, okay, this is so funny. First of all, Regina gets here and she's like, so what are we talking about? And I'm like, I don't know. We just shoot the shit.
We're very unprofessional.
We're so unprofessional. Basically, all we do is
record. That's the charm.
Yeah. We record mine and Barb's conversation, which is what the concept of this whole shenanigan really was to begin with. We just added Phil, our engineer, so that he can make sure
that it sounds good.
That it sounds good.
Yes.
So, Regina, I have known for 265 years, Matt.
You're the tannest vampire I've ever met.
So we met, I don't even know. I think it was like in the late 80s, maybe?
Yeah. Since we're being honest AF and dating ourselves, clearly.
Well, we were 10.
Wait a minute. Let me think to what apartment I was in when I met you.
You were on Orange. You lived on a street called Orange,
No, Rossmore.
Rossmore. That's it. Close to Orange, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So Rossmore and
in Hollywood.
Yes. Okay. So that would have put us around 87.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. So we met at our modeling agency because at that time, Kate Moss was becoming really big. And
it was agencies, hip for everybody to have a petite division.
A petite division. They all yes. wanted these smaller girls that were like kind of heroin chic, you know, tiny girls. That was the big fuss at that time. So Regina and I both got signed. And our agent.
We were the only two in the petite division.
I think we were.
Weren't we?
Yeah, we were. Okay.
And at LA Models.
Yeah, at LA
Heinz
Models.
Holba.
Exactly. And you had red hair, fiery red hair at the time. And I was, just the same kind of as I am now, a brunette. Well, you know, now it's dyed brunette, but.
Well, it's maintained.
It's maintained.
Yes.
I like that.
Just enhancing what God gave you. That's all.
Yeah. So we met as models and we started to kind of hang out. And one of the things that we both had in common is we both had this illness, which is we were into Dirty Rocker Boys.
We almost said that at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was late 80s, the Sunset Strip. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We were into Dirty Rocker Boys.
Yep. Mine, I ended up marrying.
Yes, you did. You were already living with Gilby at the time.
Yeah, I was already living with Gilby. And Regina and I would go out all the time and get up to absolutely no good. We would go out and go to all the clubs. We would go to the rock shows together.
Coconut Teaser.
Yep.
Madame Wong.
Gazzari's, yes. I'm sure.
Sometimes Gazzari's, but mostly the more Hollywood ones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we didn't really go to Gazzari's that much.
And then Cantor's after everything closed.
Yeah. And we go to like the Viper Room and, you know, but like in 87, I wasn't even 21 yet. So I was still a kid.
No, me either. Because Zach had gotten the gig with Ozzy in 87.
Yeah.
So I was still living in New Jersey. I moved out to California in 88.
Right.
We had a couple years still before we were 21.
So crazy. We were so young. We did the whole rock scene together. I don't know how we never ran into Barbara Ann Wild.
You know what? Sharon Osbourne wouldn't allow us to hang out. We were like, we were home in bed early.
Sequestered.
Except for when Zach got away from her, then, you know, but she was known to pull him by his ear out of many a night at the Rainbow and, you know, why aren't you in the hotel? But I still lived in Jersey until 88 anyway. So, but we never really, Zach definitely had a romance with alcohol for a decade, but we definitely didn't, you know, hang out in Hollywood very much.
Right.
So, yeah. Missed out.
That's all we ever did was we were like running around from like the Roxy, the Whiskey, the Troubadour, the Viper Troubadour. Room, Madame Wong's West, Madame Wong's East. We ran from club to club. And then I don't know why, but we figured this out the other night because it was Regina's birthday and she had a beautiful little dinner party at Craig's. Mm-hmm. And which is such a yummy restaurant in LA. If you're listening and you're not from LA and you're visiting, go to Craig's. It's a total scene too. We realized that you weren't at our wedding, which was so weird. And I don't remember why. I think we just kind of lost touch. We drifted apart at some point.
Yeah, we did. That was when I started getting into acting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of switched my circle of friends. Not consciously.
We weren't good enough anymore, the Rockers.
No. It's just that I started pursuing my own dreams and that put me around more actors and directors. And I just kind of stopped hanging out at clubs late because I had early auditions.
Yeah.
And then I kind of drifted away from people that I didn't really want to drift away from. I just, you know, like we were all out striving.
You changed your scene.
Yeah. And so just by accident.
Did you grade up or did you grade down, would you say?
It was linear. it was a linear grade.
Side
not
step.
Going there. Yes.
Very good. Very good. Regina, you got into acting and let's tell everybody your story.
Is this the 30-second elevator pitch? Okay.
Well, 30-minute.
I got into acting. I did a few bits. My first role was on Saved by the Bell. And then I was a mermaid in the movie Hook. And then I did some music videos. And then
I don't even think I knew that.
You didn't know I was in Hook?
No. I don't think I realized that.
Yeah.
Wow, I learned something new every day.
Yeah. I had my first screen kiss with Robin Williams.
Wow. In Hook. That's crazy.
Yeah. So it was me and two other girls. We were the mermaids. We beat out like 1,000 women who auditioned for this role.
Well, did look like a mermaid with that long red hair.
Yeah. He wanted a blonde brunette and a redhead.
Yeah.
But then he put wigs on us. It didn't even matter. But it was originally a big part with a lot of dialogue. And I thought,
This
is my big break. And I didn't have anybody mentoring me at the time. And even my agents and managers weren't really guiding me. And so I thought, I've got my ticket. Like, I'm set. And so it took so long between the booking of the job to actually even filming the job. It was like almost a year. And so at that moment, this is where I screwed up. At that moment, all the casting people were like, who are these girls that are in this movie? Let's bring them in for our set. And I was like, Children of the Corn 4? I don't think so. I don't want to be on Baywatch. I don't want to be on that. Not that they were offering me. I'm just saying I was hardly even going out auditions. And when I went out, I wasn't trying hard. Because I was like, when my movie comes out, all y'all, this is, you know. And so I blew it because I had a hot moment when I could have parlayed that into something.
Mm-hmm.
Because once it came out, trust me, everyone immediately forgot me. Because even at the premiere party, right after the movie, people were going, there was mermaids in the movie?
Oh.
And I was like, oh, God. I'm fucked. Because our parts, I had 6 scenes with dialogue. And when we filmed it, it was one scene with no dialogue and one scene underwater. And then in the movie, it was one scene underwater.
Oh, no wow. Dialogue. So you ended up on the cutting room floor.
Except for like one scene underwater. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't my big break, and I totally blew that opportunity because I was young and pretty, and everybody wanted to have me in their office to read for their thing, and I blew it.
How did you get into acting at that time? Was it through the agency, through LA Models?
No. I got into an acting class, and I just took a bunch of classes, and I think a casting director came to one of my classes, which is how he brought me in for Hook.
Okay.
And I had an agent and I was going out in auditions.
Because I'm wondering, because I ended up taking acting classes too at that time. And it might have been your influence. I don't really remember, but I hated it. So that was the end of that for me. I did a couple little things also. And then I was like, oh, yeah, this isn't for me. Yeah, and the acting teacher was really mean to me. So.
Oh, yeah. Acting teachers were really mean to me, too.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
It was really hard to deal with that. They would really, they would see my cocky little attitude and they would try to knock it down.
Yeah.
And it was tough.
Did we have the same acting teacher? Was it that lady?
Who was yours? I had several. I had Daryl Hickman and...
No, I don't remember her name, actually. I don't know what I'm thinking sitting here pretending like I could remember something like that.
I know. I'd have to actually pull out one of my old resumes to look at Joan Darling.
Yeah, no. I don't remember. But anyway, so then what happened after that?
After that, I just kind of petered out because it was like starting back at square one again. Mm-hmm. Nobody really cared.
Uh-huh.
I was like, hi, I was... is there a Children of the Corn 5? I'm perfect for that. Please. So I just kind of petered out and then I kind of wandered around. You know, I just kind of drifted a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine was producing a show called Erotic Confessions.
Now, this stuff I remember.
and he booked me for an episode of it and I did it and I was like, okay, well, one and done.
Mm-hmm.
That was an experience. All right, why not? And then my phone blew up. And I was like, what are all these shows and movies? I've never heard of any of this stuff. When I go in Blockbuster, I don't see this on the shelf.
You have to go in the back.
Yeah. So the joke's on them because I'll get paid for all these jobs and nobody will ever see these. I don't see these. No one's going to know I did these. And so I did about 40 of them. And then... because it takes so long for post-production. By the time the first one aired, by the time that Erotic Confessions aired, I had already had like 35 or 40 movies in the can.
Wow.
So I was like, no one's ever going to see this. And then the first one aired and my phone started blowing up going, oh my God, I just saw you on Cinemax. What? Who's what? Wait, everyone's watching these things? And so, yeah. So I had a minute there where I was Miss Cinemax. And some of my friends had a drinking game where if they would turn on Cinemax and they saw my face, they had to drink.
Oh.
Like right when you turn it on, boom, there I am. Take a drink.
Speaking of you being Miss Cinemax. And
we're going to move on from this, I hope.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I redeem myself later. Don't hang up now, guys.
We are.
I'm going to redeem myself later. This is not the end.
Who in this room woke up to the same thing I woke up to with Tommy Lee this morning?
Not me.
None of you heard about this?
No.
Tommy Lee posted this morning a complete frontal nude of himself.
Oh, I've seen that before.
We've all seen it before.
Well, yeah.
But posted a full frontal nude of himself on Instagram.
Lovely.
Today.
I hope my husband doesn't follow suit.
Why?
And, but it was funny because Frankie was like, oh my God, the whole internet's blowing up because Tommy posted a frontal nude. I'm like, what's the big deal? Everyone's seen it.
Yeah, multiple times.
Right? But anyways, so then after your...
Superstardom on Cinemax.
Your superstardom on Cinemax and your Academy Award ceremony and everything else. What happened after that? What career path did you take?
Then I decided to rebrand myself and I... went blonde and opened up a clothing store on Sunset and Doheny.
Oh, cool.
I had a store called Celebrity Closet Raiders.
Oh, and it was, I didn't know that.
It was retail. It was retail consignment of designer clothing from celebrities that they had
worn.
Wow. So I was on the Today Show. I was on E! News, Access Hollywood. All of a sudden, I was everywhere as the celebrity closet raider.
Wow. Go read my closet right now. Even though I'm not a celebrity. Yes. I have a lot of junk in there. I need to get rid of it.
So I did that for a minute. But then that was around 2007. And I had a brick and mortar store, which I realized that I hated having a brick and mortar business.
Mm.
I don't ever want to own something where I have to turn a key to get to it because it's just a nightmare. You have to have employees and deal with crap and people, and I don't like that. And it was around the time, and I was selling used handbags for $2,000, and then the housing market crashed.
Mm-mm.
And people weren't spending money anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I closed the brick and mortar store and I did
this was 2008-ish.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah, when the Hollywood had Hollywood was on strike and it was all yes. kinds of craziness. Yeah.
So I got out of that and I had always wanted to make a documentary. I'd always wanted to direct something, and I had always thought after I saw this documentary called Roger and Me, I thought that is a language that I could speak in. Like I just that documentary made me think I could do this because it was such a perfectly well-made film that spoke to me and my skills, and it just fired up my brain. But I didn't have a topic.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of put that on the back burner. And then I was living on the money from my store, my savings. I started doing PSAs for charities, like a Humane Society. I was getting celebrities to do PSAs. I was writing and directing PSAs for the Humane Society. Just getting celebrities to talk about anti-dog fighting or anti-seal hunt and mm-hmm. whatever.
I remember you doing that. And then you were dating.
Then I met Frankie.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet Frankie?
Okay. I had first met Frankie on October 20th of 1983.
Uh-huh.
When I was still living in South Carolina and I was a teenager. And that was about...
And that's where you're originally from, right?
Yes, I'm from South Carolina.
And tell everybody who Frankie is.
Frankie Benali, the drummer of Quiet Riot.
Okay.
Quiet Riot had their album, Mental Health, was going up the charts. And they were opening for Iron Maiden. And I met him about a week or... No, about a month before their album hit number one. I was a teenage girl and my friend knew Frankie and she called him and said, my friend Regina is in South Carolina, like put her on the list or whatever. And I hung out with him for a few days
mm-hmm.
and I had the biggest crush on Frankie, but I was a little kid with braces.
Right.
And they all treated me like a little sister.
Yeah. How old were you?
I think I was 18, but I was really innocent.
Yeah.
Or 17. I might have been 17.
Girl, I don't remember you being innocent.
I was innocent. Oh, yeah. I was an innocent little girl. But I had the biggest crush on Frankie. But they were, I was a little girl to them.
Yeah.
And I went to several of their shows. I rode on their bus. I hung out with them in their rooms. I was like so enamored.
Sure.
And Frankie and I were kind of flirting, but I kind of blew it with him because I was so dumb that I had said, or I was hanging out with him and I was like, oh my God, it's like, I was totally starstruck. I'm like, this is Quiet Riot. Like I'm starstruck by all of them. And Carlos said, hey, you want to, I'm going to go get a sandwich. You want to come with me? And I'm like, oh my God, Carlos Cavazo was asking me to go get a sandwich. Yeah, I'm going to go get a sandwich. And so Frankie walks over and he goes, why are you talking to him? And I go, what? Why would you care? We're just friends. And he goes, oh, okay, fine. And he walked away. And I was like, that's weird. That was a weird reaction from my dumb little brain. And so we're eating sandwiches. And I go, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Carlos, where's the phone? I have to call Frankie at the hotel right now. I screwed up. I said, we're just friends. And I meant you and me are just friends. And he thought I was saying... You and me are friends. Why do you care who I talk to?
Uh-huh.
And I told
him. So you realized at that minute that he was interested in you.
And that I had screwed up.
Okay.
And so Frankie was like kind of giving me the shoulder the whole rest of the time. And I was like, Frankie, I meant me and him. I didn't mean me and you. And he was like, whatever. I remember him specifically going, whatever. But, you know, we stayed friends and then I moved to New York to be a model. And then our lives went in completely different directions.
Right.
So completely forgot all about each other. And then around 2009,
which is how many years later? Like 20 something years later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always had friends in the music business because I had come up around musicians.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was practically raised by musicians from the time I was 17. That was how I left home. I was in bumfuck Nowheresville and musicians are coming through and I'm like, oh my God, these are like my kind of people. I need to be in a big city wearing cool clothes and doing something like a circus life like this. This is what I need to be doing. And so, and they were always like, hey, why are you in this town? You need to be in New York or LA. So those were all my friends. So around 2009, I was pitching reality shows and none of them ever happened, but I was pitching a reality show with Stephen Piercy. We had an idea that we were going to do together and it involved like 80s rockers. So I had gone to, this story is getting so long.
Stephen Piercy from Rat.
I know. Mm-hmm. So I was at a Rat show and Carlos was there and I said, oh my God, Carlos, hey, I know you don't remember me, but because now I'm an old lady, you know. And he's like,
you're not allowed to say that. You're a woman of a certain stature.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
But he goes, Regina from the East Coast? And I was like, oh my God, yes. And then it got my brain. I was like, oh, Frankie was the one I really liked. And I thought, oh, well, we actually need rockers for this thing we're pitching. And I have to like go and find people because we were going to make a sizzle reel. So I sent a message to Frankie on MySpace. I mean, hey, you know, I know you don't remember me from whenever, but.
Yeah, I remember MySpace.
Yes. And he writes me back and he goes, I'm not sure I remember you, but I'm single and I'd like to take you out for coffee.
Don't even know who you are, but I'll take you out to coffee. Fabulous.
And I was like,
that must have felt good.
I was like, okay. And then our first date was on August 11th, 2009, which was exactly 13 years ago today.
I was just going to say, it is August 11th.
Wow, yes. That's crazy.
And from that moment on, we were together. There was no iffiness or dating other people or like it was from August 11th on.
Yeah. Just sparks flew. You guys were madly in love.
We were. Yes.
Yeah.
I was the first woman he dated after his wife died.
Oh, his wife passed away?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was married for like 17 years or together with her for, I don't know.
Oh, wow. Married,
but she passed away in April of 2009.
Wow.
But they were already separated right before she died.
Okay.
But
so then you guys got married.
So we got married and then right before we got married, we were living together and engaged. He was retired when I met him.
Mhm.
And he says, "I'm going to get I've been thinking about getting the band back together and I'm going to go talk to Kevin's mom and get her blessing to put the band back together." And I laughed. I go, oh my God.
Kevin Dubrow.
Yeah. I said, this sounds like one of those things you would see on the Sundance Channel. This sounds like a documentary. You're going to go meet with your dead singer's mother and get her permission to go on with the band. And I go, oh my God, I want to make a documentary. Let me make the documentary about this. And so he let me follow them around. And I thought this was going to take a few months. And it ended up taking 4.5 years.
Wow.
Because the story kept changing and going on and getting bigger and, you know,
and you guys were already married at
the
time.
We were already living together.
Living together. Okay. And when did you get married?
November 11th of 2015.
Okay.
We made it official, even though it was.
Yeah.
We eloped. We told no one we eloped.
Wow.
So I made the documentary and I sold it to Showtime. And from then.
I saw the documentary. You did an amazing job. Did you see that documentary, Phil? You should watch it. She did a great job on it. I really thought you really did a great job on it.
What's it titled?
It's Quiet Riot. Well, Now You Hear There's No Way Back. It's on iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, and a few other places.
Isn't it so interesting how if you stay open in life, in your journey, you just never know where things are going to take you and the twists and turns that your career even, not just your personal life, but your career is going to take. You know, you went from like modeling to acting to all of a sudden you're directing documentary films.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
I know. And because of somebody in my household and what's going on in their life.
Yeah.
It presented a story that I was right there primed and ready to jump on.
I'm always so interested in that and how like things can just take a twist. And if you're open enough, you can explore it and just kind of go down a different, completely different road and pivot. I think it's really cool. So you guys were married, you made the documentary, and then Frankie got sick. Right.
So I was kind of getting ready to, I wanted to move on to directing scripted films. I didn't want to go into the doc world. I don't want to do true crime. That was just a one and done. I'm always ready to go to the next thing. I feel like every time I do something, everybody wants me to keep doing that thing. They're like, oh, that's good. You should do that forever. I'm like, okay, well, that was, now I'm ready to do the next thing, which is scripted. So I had planned to, I was looking for scripts. I was like, now that we're all set up and we moved and we got our house, we're all settled and I can make a short film and I can just work on my things I want to work on for me. This is my time. And he's running the band and I can make a film or whatever I want to do. And then out of the blue, just a complete shock to both of us, he was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer out of nowhere.
And you told me this story, which was he had like a leg cramp is how it started, right?
We thought it was a leg cramp. Now, I didn't know anything about the body or health or anything because I've always been young and healthy and I didn't, now I can practically work at Kaiser. but it was a deep vein thrombosis, DVT. Mm-hmm. But we did not know what that was. We're like, that's a leg cramp. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, your leg. He was like, I think I hurt my leg. I don't know what's going on with my leg. It's like really hurting. And so he had just had a checkup 2 months prior and had a perfect clean
bill of health.
Except for she said, but you're anemic. So her answer to you're anemic is go home and take iron pills. Mm-hmm. Not let's find out why you're anemic. Mm-hmm. Go home and take iron pills.
Which happens all the time. I mean, how many of us have gone to the doctor and found out, you know, oh, you're deficient in this, deficient in that. I always think about that too. Like, well, why? Mm-hmm. What could be the cause of that? Why is that happening?
Yeah. And the way our medical system is they don't order scans until you have symptoms of something.
Right.
And a lot of cancers don't give symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Especially pancreatic cancer.
Pancreatic cancer hides in your body until it's ready to kill you. Mm. And that was what was happening is it was clotting his blood that was going up to his lungs and his heart and was trying to kill him at that moment. And so he was around the house with his leg hurting, and then the other leg started hurting, and we were like, okay, you didn't pull your leg and have, wait, something's going on. And so he goes, it must be the iron pills. So we looked it up, and it does say online the iron pills can give you leg cramps. So we're like, oh, so just don't take the iron pills, and we'll call the doctor and tell them what happened and drink a bunch of water, don't take the pills today, I'm going to my directing class tonight, when I get home you'll probably feel better. So I got home and he was like, no, I'm worse. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, you got to go. We need to go to the emergency room. And he said, no, I've got an appointment for day after tomorrow. I'll be fine. The next morning, he suddenly had shortness of breath as well.
Oh, my God.
And he still wouldn't go to the doctor. And so after a while, I just said, put your shoes on. We're going to the emergency room. Not because I thought I was saving his life. If he had really pressed back on that, I would have said, okay. I was just thinking, let's just get whatever prescription you need so you'll feel better sooner.
Yeah.
Not let's save your life. But when we got there, they were panicked and racing around. They hung a bag of something and put it in his arm. And we just thought, oh, they're giving him fluids. And they were racing back and forth and giving him an EKG. Sir, do you have any pain in your chest? You know, they looked very panicked. And we were like, what's going on with that? Like,
well, my husband suffers from blood clots. And if you have shortness of breath and you have leg pain below the knee, or actually it's even worse if it's above, they're instantly going to think you're going to have a pulmonary emboli. So they're going to, you know, they kill you or they don't. When the clots break off and they go to your lungs, it's 50-50.
Yeah.
My husband has 3 pulmonary emboli, so I'm very schooled in blood clots.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were not at the time.
No, most people aren't.
So when they came back in the room and said, okay, because they had x-rayed him, you know, over the course of this night, and they said, you came in time, thankfully. And we were like, in time for what? He said, if you had waited till tomorrow morning, you would be dead.
Mm.
And we were, and we thought that was the bad news. We were like, what? You know, and they said, you're going to be on blood thinners for the rest of your life. And we thought that was bad news. And
because at that point, they didn't even know.
No.
They just thought he had a blood clot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they were x-raying to watch the blood clots dissipate, and they caught the top of his liver on the x-ray, and it had spots all over it.
Oh, my God.
And they go, oh, you have liver cancer. And I was already home. This is like 3 a.m. They had sent me home because I live close by, and they were like, oh, just... you should go home.
Yeah.
And I thought everything was fine, you know. And he called me and he said, they just told me I have liver cancer.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, okay. You can get a new liver. They can cut those out. They can laser it. They can radiation. No, we can fix this.
How long had you been married at this point?
We were together for 11 years, but we were only married like 4.
Mm.
But so then they said to him, after we talked, they said to him, liver cancer doesn't usually start in the liver. So let's do some more scans.
No, God.
And they did a lower scan. Yeah. And they said, and then they said to him, it's pancreatic cancer that has spread to the liver. And he said, well, how long do people usually live with this? And they said, 6 months.
Oh, my God.
So the next call to me was, I've got 6 months to live.
Oh, my God.
And it went from leg cramps to 6 months to live in like 12 hours.
You must have felt like you were going to pass clean out.
Yes. I let out a blood-curdling howl. And I knew nothing about any of this, and I was in complete and utter shock.
Yeah. And you're relatively young people.
Yeah. I never expected this.
No.
And he was getting checkups every year and blood work, and
yeah,
everything looked good. And we trusted in his doctors that they had this, like, we don't have to worry about it because you got this.
Well, most people do, you know. Yeah. It's like you go for your checkups. And you're like, okay, I'm good.
But no one ever thinks that. But really, you have to be your own doctor.
Yeah.
And his father had died of pancreatic cancer.
Oh, really?
And they knew that.
Oh, wow.
And they never ordered just routine scans, because that's not how it's done. You don't get scans until you have symptoms, but there's no symptoms.
Wow.
Even if your father died of it. So a simple scan would have...
Especially if you have, you know, family history and stuff like that. It's so important to... I love the scan that you get. What is that scan where it scans your whole body?
The DEXA scan?
Yeah.
But that's for bone density. You do have to be your own advocate.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And your loved ones' advocates, for sure. But I will say that, you know, there's two schools of thought, right? So... we hear what we want to hear. So when a doctor tells you, oh, your blood work looks great, you're like, you heard exactly what you want to hear. You want to believe mm-hmm. that. So you kind of just forget about it. But then I have friends and have known people in my life that want to be sick and are determined to find out that there's something wrong. And if we look hard enough, every one of us has something. It doesn't have to be major. But there are so many new scans, there are so new blood tests now that just got approved that can determine like 81 cancers before they're detectable in any other way. There's tons of things, but you have to do it yourself, like the bone density test.
Yeah.
It's not covered by insurance unless you have a fall,
right?
Or unless you have
unless
some sort of issues.
Orders it.
So,
yeah.
But I went to this, I think what you're talking about is there's a company called Forward that is kind of like a membership,
I
very up and coming.
I've been thinking
amazing.
About that.
Honestly,
should I join that?
I highly recommend it. Okay. It's been amazing for me. And basically what they even use your raw data if you do 23andMe. They will take the raw data that'll be downloaded and they can tell you like genetically a million and one things that you have a predisposition for so that they have you be on alert and be proactive because wow. There are a lot of things we could prevent just yeah. by knowing that, hey, I have a propensity that I may end up with this. Mm-hmm. So let me eat these certain things or take these certain supplements or what have you. But anyway, I went and got my blood work taken from them and instantly right there and then they don't call you and tell you what your results are. They scan it right then and then. They have every doctor has the capability to have your blood drawn and gone through right then and there. You don't have to wait for days for the results to come back. Forward takes it right then and there. They tell you and they put it up on a big giant whiteboard and computer, like kind of like a big iPad now. And they say, oh, okay, so here's where your cholesterol is at. Here's where this is at. Here's where your, you know, liver panel is, this, that, and the other. And they'll say to you, I mean, for me, fortunately, everything was brilliant, except he said the only thing that I don't know, because we don't have the capabilities here, is a DEXA scan for bone density. He said, and unless you have some sort of crazy accident or something, as a doctor educated based upon everything that I'm seeing here, the only thing that you could probably have an issue with is if your bone density isn't great, you break a hip. Most people, he said something crazy, like 87% of people after they break a hip die within a year. So he said, that's something that we should do a scan. It won't be covered by insurance. See, that's the thing is a lot of times all those proactive things aren't covered by insurance because it's like you said, you have to have something wrong before they'll give you a scan. Right. But that Forward company is very proactive. It's basically you're being your own advocate and you're taking control of your health. I'm actually doing the DEXA scan again on the 18th of August. There's a mobile place that does it now. It's incredible. Oh, I'll put it,
yeah.
I'll tag it.
Yeah, sure.
And they appear at different gyms all throughout Southern California. And I think a couple of other West Coast states. And you just sign up. It's $59. You go on there. They have a mobile unit. They totally do a DEXA scan. Kim Kardashian just did it. It made a big thing about how her bones were better than 98% of the people in the world
And Kim Kardashian steps out of the house and it's a big fucking
anyway,
ordeal.
But no, but it's a great company.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to do that again because before I had to go to the hospital to do it.
Yeah.
But I agree with you.
I'm going to do that. I did do a full body MRI.
Yeah, that's cool. That's good
to get
too.
A full body MRI.
That is not inexpensive.
No, it was $4,500.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But honestly, I mean, if we had known you could do that, don't you think we would have rushed Frankie? That would have been the best $4,500 we would have spent.
Right.
Because we just didn't know. We didn't know, A, that he needed that, or B, that you could do that. I found out all this stuff while I was caring for him because I instantly became, when he got diagnosed, instantly became his full-time caregiver. Now I'm taking care of every single thing in the house.
His advocate.
All of our pets. Researching and advocating for him and now taking over all his responsibilities with the band because he was the manager and the tour manager.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I took I'm buying flights with one computer and researching pancreatic cancer with another computer.
Oh my gosh.
It was a harrowing 16 months.
I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, when I found out, I know you and I had lost touch for quite a few years. We'd run into each other at events here and there and things like that. But we hadn't really connected in quite a while. And then when I found out that Frankie had passed, I reached out to you because I was just like, oh, my God, poor Regina. How is she even dealing with this? Yeah. And you were only married, 4 years. And now it's been how long?
It's on August 20th. It'll be 2 years.
2 years. Oh, wow. Oh, it's it's something that you just don't even think about, and especially when you're young. Like, I mean, I know we're not young, but I consider us somewhat young.
Yeah, it's a weird time to be widowed because, I'm, if you look at it, like if you're widowed really young, as tragic as that is, you're still so young that your life hasn't really happened yet. And you still have your life to live from the pretty much the beginning.
Yeah.
Or if you're widowed late in life, that's kind of the natural way to, or for that to be. And you just kind of live out your rest of your life as a widow. But I'm like in this weird middle place where I'm too young to just be a single widow for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But yet I'm not starting over. So it's a weird place because now I'm like back in the dating world
again. Right. Did it take you a certain amount of time before you went, okay, I need to start getting myself back up there. I got to dust myself off. You know, like, what do you say to other people that are widowed and how do they get through that?
I don't know because I'm just kind of figuring that out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew when he was diagnosed that I would be dating again. I knew that I wanted to find love again because I loved being married. I loved being part of a team. That was the most natural position for me.
Mm-hmm.
I love being with one person.
Right.
And having that best friend that I do everything with. And that we shave off each other's rough corners and make each other better. And I thrive in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if I never find it again, I will be fine because I had it. I had a man that loved me more than life itself. And if I never find that again, I'll be okay. Because I have it. A lot of people don't get it at all.
Yeah. Aww.
But anyway, I don't want to go there.
There's tons of 28-year-olds out there, so don't worry. Yeah. You don't have to.
But Frankie knew that I was going to move on, and we talked about it. And he's fine with it.
Yeah.
He just, you know, he just wanted to make sure it was somebody good.
He just wanted to make sure you'd be taken care of and you'd be happy. He wants you to be happy.
He left me very well taken care of.
Yeah.
He just doesn't want anyone that would want to take advantage of me.
Right.
Or like live off of me.
Right. Right.
But other than that, he was fine with it.
And then you started, you know, you've always been like super ambitious and busy. You started managing his legacy in a sense and the band.
Well, the funny thing was, is when I made the documentary, I researched the hell out of the band and I was helping him through the process of rebuilding the band. So every decision that he made, we made together.
Right.
So it was actually a training ground for me, which I didn't know I was in. I was in basic training for something I didn't know I was going to get handed.
Yeah.
So now I'm the band's historian and archivist and the carrier of the flame.
Right.
And the defender of the legacy.
I don't know how you do that. Like, I'm always amazed by what you do and what Barb does and Sharon Osbourne. Like, I have been around Gilby and his music and his business and the music business for, I don't know, forever now, like 255 years. But I wouldn't have the slightest idea on how to like manage it and manage him. Like, I just don't think that I'm...
I think you do a pretty good job with Frankie. I don't know if you're being fair to yourself.
I don't manage her, though. I mean, I don't really know
it's you kind of just go with the flow, right? I mean, the music industry changes on a daily, hourly.
You learn as you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the decisions that are presented to you, I don't wake up every day thinking I know everything that I'm doing, but things happen and the decision is right there. And I can see what would be better for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so one decision at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just go one decision at a time and what's the best for the brand, the band, his legacy, and us.
So what is going on now with the band?
Well, I got Rudy Sarzo back in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And we're touring. I think in 2022.
Oh, he's an original member.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So I got an original member back in.
Right.
Because Frankie was the only original member.
Mm-hmm.
So I got Rudy back, and we're in 2022. I think we're going to play about 75 or 80 shows.
Whoa.
So
that's a lot.
Good for you. That's great.
Yeah. That's a lot.
So we brought in some some new people as far as the booking side of it. And, you know, we've shaken a few things up. And next year we'll be adding meet and greets and merch. And I'm redoing the whole merch profile. I got out of a merch deal that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting a new one.
Wow, that's
good,
amazing. And then you still have time to do your other stuff or no? But you weren't you aren't you an intimacy coach too?
Yeah, I do that as well.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's get into the intimacy coaching.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Tell us about that and how that happened.
Okay. Well, remember when I did all those movies,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of nudity and intimacy simulated romantic scenes in those movies. So
right.
I have experience as an actor in that. And so when this new job came around, actually before Frankie was diagnosed, I started training as an intimacy coordinator because to me, I love directing and working with actors.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a way of kind of like being a second unit director, because a lot of times the director will let, not always, but they'll let you kind of take over that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I'm getting to do second unit directing on just certain scenes and work with actors and protect them from being harassed or mm-hmm. coerced into things that they don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was something I was doing before Frankie was diagnosed, and I'm still doing it, but it's kind of hard for me because I feel like I was this like hippy dippy animal rescuer artist chick that was a loving wife, but now I'm getting dragged into this band stuff and I'm becoming Sharon Osbourne. Like, how did I, like, whoa, what's happening? And so a lot of times I've been, okay, one time I was on a set.
Isn't it funny how Sharon is the pinnacle of wife management?
Yeah,
she is.
She's the ultimate wife.
Yeah.
Like I'm on a set dealing with actors and I've got a booking agency calling me, complaining about something going on, or band guys calling me with drama. And I'm like, okay, stop. Hold on just one second. Like, okay, so what is the backline situation going on? Well, you tell those motherfuckers that we won't play the fucking show. They better get that back line there. Okay, thanks. All right, so where were we? Or one time I was having a phone conversation with an actress who was very nervous about her first nude scene.
Uh-huh.
And I'm on the phone with her. And I'm like, okay, listen, it's going to be fine. And she's like, what if he gets an erection? I'm like, okay, well, if he gets an erection, we will not shame him. We will just pause, let him take a breather. You know, because it's natural. The body thinks, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing now. And it works separate from the brain. And, you know, we're not going to shame him or embarrass him. We're just going to take a break. And I'm having this conversation in a car with the whole band.
Oh, my God.
You were all sitting there like.
That's great.
Looking like, ew, what is that? I'm like, guys, just give me a second. Sorry. Anyway. So if he gets an erection, it'll be okay. All right. So, you know, those worlds are stepping all over each other all the time. And it is hard. I don't have the.
What do they do in those instances when they're like on set and they're in a heated scene? Are they like wearing certain things to.
Yeah, there's all kinds of modesty garments and protection that you put. Place depending on the camera angle
uh-huh.
and the body's angle.
Uh-huh.
You put pads in between them, pillows in between them. You put them at an angle where you can't see right there. And then sometimes one of my tricks that I started, I don't know if somebody else thought of it too, but I thought of it and now I see it a bunch of other intimacy coordinators doing it, is I take a small exercise ball and I semi-deflate it and I put it like between the actor's legs here, and then the actress sits on top of it.
Oh.
And she can bounce away. and they're not
brilliant.
Touching.
Oh my God, that is genius.
So,
tricks of the trade.
Yeah, there's definitely tricks.
Because I always wonder about that. I'm like, oh my God, can you imagine?
Like when someone's face is right there and there's like a thigh and their face is right there.
Yeah, like, I'm like, it's like porn.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Now that I know what's really happening.
There's probably a styrofoam, or not styrofoam, but memory foam taped to her crotch and his face is like just sitting on the memory foam.
Oh.
There's Yeah, you never really make contact.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is, because I always thought, like, it looks like porn to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I know, I know. And I remember when I was doing those movies, I would get asked, are you guys really having sex? And I was like, I was perplexed at how I would even be asked that question. Like, you know that movies aren't real, right? You know that when we kill somebody in the film, they're not really dead.
Right.
Why would you actually have sex? If you can't see penetration between the actors, why would they actually do it?
Well, you know, it's your own fantasy and your own little dirty mind.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That is just so fascinating. Regina, you are like a jack of all trades.
Absolutely.
It's master of nothing.
No, you are. You are a master of quite a bit, actually. I mean, who would have thought to put a little bouncy exercise, deflated bouncy exercise?
I'm never going to look at mine again
legs.
The same way.
Right? I think you're quite the genius.
Yes. But I really want to direct a feature. And I'm determined to get the band set up in such a way that we're almost there. We are such a well-oiled machine. Everybody is a team. I mean, like last week, a flight got postponed and Rudy was on the phone and I stayed up all night booking another flight. And then the drummer is like, okay, we'll just drive to New Orleans and go to that airport. And everybody figured out the solution to the problem. Like, we are a team.
Yeah.
If something goes down there, it will not stop Quiet Riot. Quiet Riot will not die. If Kevin DeBrow dying didn't kill Quiet Riot, nothing will.
That's hysterical.
That's funny.
Nothing will kill this band. You cannot kill this band. But I want to get to the point where I could actually direct a feature and have that band still running without needing me for something while I'm on set and actually direct a feature.
You should do it.
That's my goal.
Do it. Just do it. Make it happen.
I have to find a script. And it's hard to get something greenlit. And, you know, it's like starting all over again. No one believed in my documentary, and then I made the documentary. And now everyone's like, make documentaries. And I'm like, no, I want to make a feature. And I was like, oh, we don't believe in you for that. It's like, well, no one's ever believed in me for any step of the way. I have to keep proving myself. It's like, well, I did all those things that nobody said I could do, and now I want to do this.
So, Regina, I don't know if we can talk about this or not, but if we can't, then we'll just edit it out. But I have to ask you, because it's stuck in my memory banks, and I just went and saw them play. That Blondie song.
Oh, yeah.
The mention of your name in that song.
Yes.
Is that really about you?
If it is, they will never admit it.
Uh-huh.
Because at the time they were recording the song, I was dating Clem Burke.
Right.
And I was in the studio. I went to the studio one time in Electric Lady, and Debbie said to me, oh, you're Regina. I was wondering who's Regina. And I thought, oh, she just means somebody mentioned me. And then they were recording that song.
It's stuck in my memory banks forever. Right. And every time I hear that, what's the name of the song again?
It's called Maria.
Maria, right?
But we broke up and he was with another woman who he's now married to.
Yes.
So
Ellen.
For the love of God, they will never, ever say that song about me.
Yeah.
They will never say that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think it is, but.
But maybe not.
I don't really care.
Yeah.
Either, because whatever.
It always reminds me of you because I hear the song and I love that song.
And it was like Maria, 30 years ago.
In the chorus, it switches from Maria to Regina.
It says Regina Ave Maria.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's certain things about this character in that seem like won't come in from the rain. Yeah, that was kind of me in that relationship. I wouldn't come in from the rain. I was definitely foolish there, but I was, you know, this was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was 100 years ago.
130 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares? I mean, I dated him, like, it wasn't even a year. It was like maybe, I don't know, a few months. I don't remember. It was so long ago.
So, Regina, Barb and I always talk about this on the podcast. We talk about beauty. Do you have like a favorite product or anything that keeps you fresh and young and youthful?
Okay. You've clearly never been to my house.
No, I have not.
With or without batteries is fine.
Both of my upstairs bathrooms, the cabinets are packed.
Well, so are ours, trust me.
And then I had to eventually get a unit of storage in the bedroom to store more products.
Yeah.
Because I buy everything. And I can't even tell you what I use because when I go to wash my face, I open the drawer of cleansers.
But what's your one product that you can't live without?
Or that you've rebought? Yeah. Because that's the big tell-all for me.
Yeah, rebuying is... That is
I rebought. I've kind of gotten... I was into Dr. Paragon products for a while in around 2007. And then when I was dating Dr. Paragon.
Wow!
I dated Dr. Paragon.
That's the information we kind of needed.
Yeah.
Well...
Does he really make you eat a lot of salmon?
Yes. And he tested creams on me that he hadn't... That he hadn't put out yet and stuff, but that was like a blip.
His cold plasma cream is fabulous.
Yeah, so I've kind of started rebuying that stuff.
It's good. It's really good.
And the serums. Uh-huh. So I'm kind of getting more into that again.
Well, there you have it.
And Retin-A. I'm getting back into Retin-A.
Retin-A. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I used Retin-A in my entire 20s because I had acne, and that was what they gave you for acne. Mm-hmm. But it also kept me from wrinkling.
It's right. The only thing proven. Yeah. Only thing proven to rid you of them.
Yes. Yeah. And so in my 30s, everyone was saying, oh, that's out of style now. No one's doing Retin-A. Everyone's doing glycolic acid. And so I was like, okay. And I got out of Retin-A. But then I always was thinking, why did I ever stop Retin-A? That was what was working.
Well, it also makes your skin sensitive and you can't go in the sun.
Very sensitive to the sun.
Yeah, you have to be really careful with
it. You have to be very careful. Fun.
It's ironic that you bring that up because my sister came over the other day and her skin looks gorgeous.
Well, your skin is like glass.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, her skin is retarded.
Ridiculous. My sister looked gorgeous. And I said to her, what are you doing to your skin? Your skin looks so good. And she said, believe it or not, I was breaking out a little bit. And now Differin Gel, which is Retin-A based, is now over the counter. It used to be a prescription for Retin-A from the derm. And she's been using it. And she like put it on a couple of spots and it cleared them up. But it also made her skin look like tighter and less visible pores. So she started using it everywhere. And she's like, it's literally Retin-A back from the day. It's like, it's proven. I mean, it works.
Yeah, we all should have never stopped that. That
we all should have stayed out of the sun. Well, Barb never went in the sun, and neither did you, but I did.
I went in a little bit.
Regina.
Are we done?
We're done.
What?
It was painless, right?
Did we even finish anything? I don't know. Okay.
Well, we talked about a lot of stuff.
We'll have you back on when we go to your premiere.
Like I sat down 10 minutes ago.
Really? I think it's been about an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. It's amazing once you start gabbing.
I know.
How quick the time flies.
I know. And we skipped right over all my stories about you when you were...
Oh, my God. You have stories about me?
Well, you were actually kind of innocent. I was the single one.
Yes.
You were the one who had a boyfriend and I was the single one.
Right. You were up to no good.
Up to no good.
Yeah. She's much more innocent than she looks, right?
Yeah. She doesn't... Yeah. Yes.
Looks like sex and she's like such a good girl.
I was your co-conspirator.
That's true. We had many phone conversations about boys.
That's right.
Uh-huh. You know all my secrets, probably.
I kind of do. Mm-hmm. At least the ones from those days, I do.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Well, all right. Well, this has been fun, ladies.
It was lovely to meet you.
It was fun having you. And it's always fun for us to have another rock wife on.
Absolutely.
Someone that, you know, understands and you know, we all kind of go through a lot of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. So thank you for coming and visiting with us and sharing your story.
We'll have you back on when you have your premiere.
Yeah, anytime you want to come back on, you come back on. I hope you enjoyed this episode with the lovely Regina Benelli. Hit us up on our socials. Honest AF Show is our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. HonestAFShow.com is our website. Do you have like any handle that you want to announce or no?
I'm Regina Benelli on all of the social medias. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I have a website, intimacycoordination.com. QuietRiot.band is the band's website.
Yeah.
Quiet Riot on Facebook. Yeah, I'm easy to find.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And until next time, y'all take care. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
We obviously need to do a disclaimer here. So we want you to know we are not doctors or experts by any stretch of the imagination. We are just a couple of gals that are looking for magical products, procedures, and experiences. And in our quest, we will share our honest as fuck opinions with you. So please make sure before you try anything we talk about that you know your own restrictions and do so at your own risk. Do not blame us for any of your issues. We're just experimenting too.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation. Slaycation.